Viki now. I read somewhere that I now forget that a good translation of a particular work is actually more beautiful than the original work. Or at least what I read said something like this provocative statement. Joanna Rocco writes of V's newest collection, The Proscenium, out from Ugly Duckling Press, which, addendum, everyone should check out after the reading, copies available at the merch table in the back, aka UDP's web store, where they're now doing this PIN, Poets in Need, fundraising campaign that is very sweet and helps poets in need during the pandemic. But Joanna Ruoco writes, Viki Now's language isn't made of words like everyone else's. From my first experience with Viki Now's poetry, the beautiful Sheep Machine book, which tracks second by second a corresponding cinema, recommended to me by my writer astronaut friend, for whom the recommendation was so important, it consisted not actually in conversation, but in just sending me the book. That the idea of a translation which becomes a kind of radiant summoning of a new reality, what I read Ryoko as gesturing towards, has been the way I've read the rest of V's work. A translation's from where or what, the writing seems to ask at the substratum, as it reads itself through the secret question, while, for instance, saying, reciting a recipe for God. The touch of each word V summons is a translation, in her own words, a symmetry of this God, or like Nagaristani describes, a program for AGI, a thought that constructs itself from a nowhere and a no-win, capable of overturning its entire state of affairs in a single breath. It is a poetry not of capturing the flesh of a deer, of a deer escaping the forest to cross paths for a moment, your oncoming car, but of getting out of the car and walking into the forest, to translate into the conditions of a poetic language itself from a departure into the dark reality of dreams. Viki Now is the author of four poetry collections, Human Tetris, Sheep Machine, Umbilical Hospital, The Old Philosopher, and now five, The Proscenium, and of the short stories collections, A Brief Alphabet of Torture, and the novel Fish in Exile. Her work includes poetry, fiction, film, and cross-genre collaboration. She was the Fall 2019 Fellow at the Black Mountain Institute. Please join me in silent claps welcoming Viki Now.
Thank you, Tasso, for that wonderful introduction. Thank you, Artist Space, and SIG Ying for hosting this. And for everyone who have appeared with me in this virtual scape, I am going to read to you. I'm also happy to be reading with Frederick Tutent as well, who is 43 years younger than me. So I'm going to give you a sample of a little bit of everything. It won't be everything that I've written, but it will include fiction, nonfiction, poetry, genre-bending form, and play-like-ish. I'll read a little, an excerpt from The Proscenium. So I'll start out with a nonfiction piece. I usually tell people that normally I read sexy stuff to give you some blue balls in your virtual reality, but I don't know if this is sexy or not. It's probably not. This one is called The Male Nurse. 10 days out of the ICU, I was ready for a human shower. I felt so dirty, like I'd given 100 men 100 blowjobs. I wanted to puke all the time. The oxycodone they gave me wouldn't go down, and I kept having these insidious nightmares about morphine and pre-vomited saliva. To curb my fetish for cleanliness, the nurses gave me an alien bath, a pre-made disposable washcloths made to remove layers of skin, sanitized human remnants, but it felt like no baths at all. When a nurse wiped my clitoris, it appeared as if she had wiped an insomniac oysters off me. Still, I couldn't feel the silicone texture of the catheter pinging my thighs like an umbilical cord. But the oyster clung its life onto the mollusk cell, soft and prenumsit, and it breathed easily like a child out of an outhouse. The surgery had converted my body into an anatomically impossible instrument. I appeared like a Hare Krishna latex trouser, inflated in all the wrong places. In 6 hours during surgery, I gained 20 pounds of water weight. They didn't even need to put me on a scale. My bed was a scale. I grew like a balloon. My face looked like bánh tiêu, Vietnamese donuts. For 6 hours, the surgeon, perfusionist, anesthesiologist, and nurses deep fried me in fentanyl and oxygen and tossed me into a hospital bed like churros into a drying rack so I could soak out all my post-surgery oil. Needless to say, I needed a bath, and each day I begged the surgeon to let me. It was hard for me to shower because for 10 days I had been plugged to everything, heart monitor, suction drains, IV, and everywhere I went, a machine went with me. After 10 days, he granted me permission. My mother was overjoyed, I was overjoyed, and my books were overjoyed. And then my mother wasn't overjoyed anymore. A female nurse volunteered to bath me, and I refused. I told the hospital that I wanted a man to. I insisted adamantly, even when the redhead nurse who looked like Amy Adams in a ponytail insisted that she would be happy to shower me. I womanly rejected her offer. My mother was devastated. If you don't let that nurse bathe you, let me do it, my mother begged. But I stay firm. My mother was the hardest critic when it came to body image. My mother, at the age of 60 years old, displays herself more closely to an Ariana Grande model. Despite being a grandmother of three, she was no grandmother. She wore sexy tights and shirts that reveal her firm abs and muscular legs. I couldn't let her see me in my deformed state. The nurse returned to my hospital bed and assured me that she would love to bath me if I would let her. I shook my head and told her that I would like to see the male nurse who would be showering me. 5 minutes later, he arrived, holding a chart and pushing a blood pressure machine. I took one glance at him and immediately declared my approval. I had to take one glance just to be sure that a doppelganger of Harvey Weinstein wasn't going to lather me with hospital soap. He was tall and lanky and had poor posture and weight. While he showered me, as warm water was coursing through my body, my mother strode back and forth in my hospital room, shaking her head in disapproval and puzzlement while mumbling, "A woman should never show her body to a man she wasn't going to sleep with. How could you? How could you?" I was sitting in this rectangular hospital stool made primarily out of aluminum. Whenever the water fell on it, it made it this empty sound like pluvial wind inside of a pipe. My mother's flummox state gave me the impression that I plucked the blood feathers of a chicken without dousing it in boiling oil first. She felt my constitution was backward and irrelevant. When she shook her head in disapproval, the male nurse was poorly lathering my hair with hospital shampoo. I wish he was gay. He would have given my oily, soiled head the kind of homosexual care it needed. But he was just a straight white man. Perhaps he was afraid to touch me because he stood over me like I was room temperature egg rolls dumped in basket of hot oil. He was worried that I might splash him, giving him second degree burns. He even scrubbed my head poorly, like he didn't know what he was doing. His fingers were undexterous and robotic. While rinsing me with the handheld shower head, he soaked his tennis shoes and the thin linings of his green scrub so that his hospital garments resemble more closely to the watermark at Lake Mead. But I prefer his incompetency over intimacy. A woman giving me a bath would have been too tender. I wanted an efficient bureaucratic shower, quick and functional. I didn't want to fall in love with the female nurse who would easily claim my soul with her tenderness. I wanted red tapes, and I just wanted to be clean without being under the influence of sapphic ardor. The hospital and older nurses thought I must have fallen in love with this tall male nurse, because on the day I was released from the hospital, they donated the discharge cast to him, giving his chivalrous service as a departing gift to compensate for how much pain I suffered during my semi-lengthy admittance. With his face and both cheeks flushed red with discomfort and abashment, he wheeled me out the hospital into the pre-thunderstorm June Iowa air. It had been raining all day. He saw my black, unruly pubic hair. He had to. After the shower, he had to wipe me down with those orderly sanitized ultra bleach white hospital towels and then dress me. I was banned from raising my arms up to lift anything. These were necessary external precautions, and such precautions made my naked body available to his male gaze, which I gave freely without shame or uneasiness. I'm going to read a poem called Xylophobe that I wrote. There are millions of you whispering your dead voices in my ears. I intentionally left your kidney in snow and your heart in my snow globe. And yet you still decide to suck on my clit like marrow being forced to withdraw itself from the bank account of a bone. I don't want to tell her that she is Goldilocks. She might touch me just right between the mother bear of my left tit and the father bear of my right clit. Outside, the forest is playing the xylophone. The mallets are sporic, rainwater clung to the tips of leaves in wild bursts. Onto the cellar trees as two women in love weave their fingers into a basket of an afternoon. When the snow walks her sister, the wind home from middle school, the dark road that leads to nowhere awaits her children like an anxious mother. When I take apart the snow globe to change snow into a thunderstorm, I discover that it is just a water softener machine. For the longest time, I thought your love for me was made out of divorce. How wrong I was to use a xenophobe for a xylophone. Before I read the last piece, I'm going to read you the proscenium, an excerpt from the proscenium, and then I'll end with a genre-bending form, just to give you a semi-sense of my work in general. This one is from page 21 of the proscenium, and it's in a play-like format. So. Balance in front of Dalí's meditative rose. When Dalí painted this rose, he was thinking of the audience only. What it would be like to paint a rose when the audience, the spectator, can't kiss, smell, pluck, taste, or touch it. Dalí was toying with our craving. He uses our imagination against us. The longer one gazes at the seductive rose, the more one desires almonds, the highest of want. He wanted to heighten impossibility, unreciprocated love. He did it in the form of a rose. He took negative space from the audience. He made love claustrophobic and without parameters. He teased and then he toiled. He painted a plucked rose. A rose without thorns and without a stem. But in gazing in our hypnotic drawer, we feel the invisible thorns in our hearts, the invisible stems, the invisible pain subverts in its invisibility and become perceptible like an ache. The more he took away the rose, the more the audience aches. To our decapitated love, the head of our covetousness, the cap of Estrella Levante, Quiroga's protagonist, the stemless, thornless rose. Magnolia, this innocent painting is grotesque. Balance, our love is beautiful because the thorns are concealed and unpainted and are replaced by the enamel of the Iberian sky. Magnolia, our love is beautiful because we do not see the thorns. Valance, let us not paint that thorn. Magnolia, let us not paint those stems. Valance, let us exist in Dali's rose. Let us be spectators of the rose. Let us be spectators of our love. Let us be spectators. Before her excursion to the heart of Andalusia, Valance wrote on a notepad left on the kitchen counter, Magnolia, please do not let me forget to put Gertrude Stein in the refrigerator. So that's from the proscenium. I originally wrote it as a, it was supposed to be a long fiction manuscript about a woman who is trying to write a novel with her typewriter by inserting the keys into her uterus and then ejecting it into a canvas, like a sheet of paper. And she'll type out each letter, but she only made it to the word, the first article of the word the. So she only wrote T, H, and E. So that's what, and I reduced the manuscript to that essence. But it was long and inaccessible and verbose. So there's only 36 pages of it, I think, there. Before I read my last piece, I want to take this moment to thank everyone for your ears, for your attentive listening, for joining me in this Las Vegas afternoon where my neighbor downstairs is playing, I don't know what kind of music, but for a while it was really vulgar. And thank you, Tasso and Ian and Sig Artist Space and for hosting us and for welcoming us with such tenderness and love and for your wonderful introduction. So this one is this one was requested that I read this one, so I'll go for it. I'm trying to remember the last time I read it. For certain, I read it once when I was in Providence, Rhode Island, maybe 7 years ago. But and then there was another time in New York, but I can't remember the space. So I think this is the third time I'm going to read this. So, and it's called When You Let Your Hair Down, Christine. Let us pretend to be grammatically hysterical for a moment. Let us pretend that there's into the world. The flowers from Whole Foods on my windowsills have desiccated to where touching one petal is like touching a piece of chalk. When the flowers, these pearlish things, lean against the glass part of the window, I think, yes, my one neonastic chalky pen, that flower is writing her pseudo calcium sulfate thoughts on the pane. As she leans like a historian collecting phantom breath into the auditory of vaporous voices of the ancient inflorescent pasts, an exhibition of voices, her face an audience absorbing the elevation of my shifting demeanor when my ex wasn't throwing soup at me or making me a type of napkin but to go. She would tell me not to be afraid to inspect the world closely, and here I am gleaning from her wisdom as one flower head as she rewrites the phantom sentence on glass. This isn't a cantrip, a noun. This isn't the highest pollution of desire. This is merely a quotidian exercise in existing. More than tilting back, I remember at night in my Providence apartment, while all stones huddle in a corner to cry alone, I imagine this is how women cry, Christine. This is how women cry into stones. They weep. I imagine this is how stones breathe. Minerals pull back the obdurate mantles to allow a century to sink and layer, and somehow the words get there. At night in my Providence apartment, I contemplate the difference between solitude and loneliness. When I think of solitude, I think of the evanescent depth of the human mind as a snowy, flexible, connective landscape from the literature between bones, cartilage, the medical dictionaries likes to call it. I think of solitude as the ontological cartilage that keeps the bones of loneliness and suffocation from rubbing. When you let down your hair, Christine, my heart is not a bathroom stall that you can flush down the water pipe. I watch a leaf curl, watch the fever, watch the delivery of an exhale, so deliberate like prostitution. Sometimes I wish the uterus could defenestrate from the window of womanhood like a cat and land outside of my quasi-feminine female body like a black snowstorm. Sometimes falling in love with a married woman does that to you. Sometimes when Christine gazes at me, all the oars in my ribs lift. Today I feel sick to my stomach with beauty and aluminum. Aluminum is fragile, it cracks, I wrote. Washing whites in winter is like having a personal snow-capped mountain made of bedsheets and lingerie before one's very eyes. The view, what a view. Sometimes when I hang clothes outside the fire escape, I wonder if the silk blouse that sits next to the cotton panty brushes, perhaps it's not the sun or the wind or the outdoor. It is too much blushing that the garments, large, small, petite, and sexy, the real reason why they get desiccated, French. The thing is, King David didn't have to annihilate a life to get Bathsheba. He could have exposed his vulnerable Hebrew, the second king of Israel, heart to her and let her decide if she wanted him. I mean, what are the chances of someone not wanting a king? If Michael Fassbender, hot and sexy, a glorious, knocks on your door and tells you how much he loves and wants you, you drop your shopping cart, your tedious husband, toss your children in some corner universe, and ask Fassbender out of the 100 rooms which room just brought out, not your hive serrano hummingbird, but your eagle-eyed thighs. On a Thanksgiving phone call to my mother excitedly persuaded me to eat more bell peppers, more kale, more vitamin C, more omega-3, and she asked if I was lonely. And I thought of Ben Luton, who once told me he used to hear really well and about saying goodbye to Peter sometimes on Hope Street after walking home as soon as poetry workshop ended. When I think of two tall men walking, I wonder if the space between their bodies is a female chronograph, stopping silence, time, and stem, whose silence is a voiceless voice, her stem trailing off between the tall legs like a winter halcyon. Sometimes it's just economical to throw her in the air, the indivisible woman that exists between the space of Ben's leg and Peter's. And I remember, yes, there was so much in the details. Most people just wanted Starbucks to enter the bloodstream, but all I wanted to do is take a nap with Christine. Sometimes when Christine lets down her hair, it seems as if my nocturnal bloodstream were transporting private cargoes of emotion across the Pacific. I imagine this cargo as it makes its way out to the mouth of the sea, which is air and exposure, the shipment of emotion, the transportations of good and delirium. I think of Rilke's marriage. Marriage is protecting each other's solitude. I used to think of solitudes as a member of the nightshade family, dangerous when inhaled mistakenly. I imagine Rilke isn't thinking of the nightshade family, eggplants and potatoes, or of different bastions in the world, the Berlin Wall or the Wall of China. I imagine that he means the roof of my mouth. I imagine protecting Christine's solitude would be the purpose of the roof, a sonic awning that travels and protects the vocal cord of Christine's existence, allowing her own voice and lunar middle sphere to breathe and occupy its own space. Rope solitude is Rodin's formal constraint on clay. Protecting a beloved solitude is protecting the fugitive material that houses the fluidity of her individuality, protecting her ontological center as her yet unhewn existence is cast into form. I think of Rodin forming, keeping with the form. When you let down your hair, Christine, it seems as if she let down her pensory opera hell. And I think of all of how the world is made of Genesis, that the earth is born of God's greatest orgasm, an orgasm that expands into a planet, that each orgasm has its own moon orbiting its planet, and how the galaxy is one big G-spot. And I think the entire cosmos has been trying to make God accountable for her pleasure, his delirium. Astronauts have been going to the outer space of this orgasm, trying to capture God's solar intergalactic desire. Perhaps I do not have the solar energy of a man, but my moon can make waves bend the undulating net of motion and see the breeze. Perhaps all love is a bit hyperbolic in writing. But at the end of a memory bank, I imagine Christine, a ladybug, and I, an ant, trying to descend together this fiberglass border of a wine glass, because the nectar of the quotidian has many pleasure in every bite as we shoulder to shoulder watch the sunset of an oyster platter flake into a human mouth. And I imagine take one silver or lamina of sugar and use it as a makeshift ligament to mend one of your six legs as you may have sprained it on your way down from the glass boulder. I imagine that we might want to inhale an assembly line of toilet light as it gets superimposed over each other over the millions of years so that I could lean Christine into my arms and ask her which bed, the oyster shell or the lettuce, as our conjugal station tonight. And we could gaze at the salad sky with her aligned stars of salt and breadcrumbs and close our eyes while the Andromeda of balsamic vinegar watches as we fall asleep, my central petal hand overlapping Christine's. Thank you for your time.